Greetings, this is your Sun Sounds volunteer broadcaster, Carol Hampton, bringing you this week's edition of Earth and Home. Today, we will be reading from Mother Earth News, February, March, 2020, HGTV.com, and Better Homes and Gardens, February, 2020. Let's get started with Mother Earth News. Bringing everyone to the table. When ideologies don't align, our mutual desire for healthy land and good food can bring us together. By Gary Paul Nabin. We're experiencing unbridled divisiveness in North America today. Yes, we've always had cultural differences, and those differences have inevitably led to social and political countercurrents as well as periodic conflicts. But that doesn't mean we're fated to live on a battleground where stalemates keep our best intentions from being realized. Of particular concern to me is the palpable anger on either side of what James Gimple has called a gaping canyon-sized urban-rural chasm. This urban-rural divide has reshaped both state and national elections into us versus them battles to determine who controls access to natural resources and social services. Americans appear to be at war with one another rather than at work with one another. Individuals of all classes, races, and ethnicities have felt increasingly disempowered by the prevalence of top-down decision-making about lands, wildlife, and plants they've known and loved. In many cases, they've become disenfranchised from policy-making processes that ignored their local knowledge, dismiss their cultural or faith-based values, and disregard impacts on their livelihoods. Whenever I've visited rural communities over the past decade, I've overheard seething frustration that environmental decision-making was increasingly being done by some confederation of self-appointed experts who hardly seemed to care whether their communities were engaged. I could feel a perplexing disconnect between people's love for their home ground and their disillusionment at having no ability to shape what would happen to it. And yet failure, despair, and a sense of being disenfranchised don't provide the entire picture. Americans' level of concern about the environment and its relation to our food security are approaching an all-time high. Most Americans still want to see conservation and restoration advance, but through a completely different paradigm, one rooted in true community engagement. Americans aren't divided about whether the environment deserves restoration. What divides us is who gets to decide how this work is done, who does it, and how much it should cost. There's a hurdle that keeps many of us from fully participating in this paradigm shift. We're hanging on to extreme judgmental views of others whose ideas and voting records don't exactly match up with our own. We must be willing to take a step toward the fertile middle ground. What Arizona rancher Bill McDonald began to refer to in the mid-1990s as the radical center. A stance in the radical center isn't some wishy-washy compromise by those who are unable to choose a side on which to stand. It's not ambivalent. Its strength is that it's multivalent. This is a disciplined position of listening intently and taking into account voices other than your own. One of the best ways to heal the divisions that have been plaguing us is to work hand in hand to heal the land. As with most things, action to restore our continent's food-producing capacity speaks louder than words. So let's see what collaborative conservation looks like on the ground. Returning water to the landscape. Fowler Clark co-founded the Cuenca de los Ojos Foundation, building collaborations that have restored more than 100,000 acres of land along the United States-Mexico border. She knew of conservationist and philosopher Aldo Leopold's descriptions of ancient trincheras, or check dams, structures built along mountain ridges in Mexico to slow floodwaters, capturing moisture and soil in land that would otherwise erode. Trincheras return water to the landscape rather than diverting it. In the 1940s, Leopold and his family watched deer browsing on the grassy benches held in place by check dams built centuries before on the Rio Gavilan, not far from Valor's own ranches near the Sonora-Chihuahua border. Valor was also aware of the exceptional stonemasonry tradition in Guanajuato, Mexico, where cantero artisans, stonecutters, have built roadways, walls, and homes out of hand-cut caliche stone for decades. And so in the 1990s, Valor began to recruit world-class stonemasons from Guanajuato to build check dams in the West Turkey Creek watershed near the Arizona-New Mexico border. I'd stayed at El Coronado Ranch for 2 days in the 1980s before Valor purchased it, when the land was virtually grassless because of years of neglect and overuse. Not long afterward, Valor and her partner at the time took over its management. Their vision for the ranch had an ecological precision right down to the kinds of grasses, trees, and wildlife they wished to restore, including the then-endangered Gould's wild turkey. On a hot summer evening in 2017, Juan Almedo, a Mexican agave farmer, and I visited Valor on El Coronado Ranch. She led us down a trail to where some of the oldest dams still stood. We veered off the beaten path toward a canyon mouth. A side drainage ran down through oaks and pines from a ridge high above us. Valor headed down into the bottom of the watercourse and stood before a 30-yard-long rock structure called a gabion, a special form of dry stone masonry check dam. She disappeared around a curve and then reappeared beneath another giant stone check dam. Little more than 5 feet tall, Valor and her floppy hat barely rose above the top of the stone structure, built from hay-baled-sized boulders, some of them easily 10 times her weight. Valor pointed to soil that rose 5 feet high at the base of the wall. It stretched out for another 50 feet before her. She explained that when her team began to restore the gully, the land was little more than rocks and barren ground. But 20 years later, the soil had built up, along with moisture and grass. You know, when you want to make a difference, sometimes you have to begin with something big, something bold, Valor said. She told us that the Guanajuato stonemasons built dozens of check dams all the way up each of the side drainages, running to the top of the ridge. Dozens, I asked, in awe of the work it took to make just the one gabion immediately before us. The canteros constructed 2 or 3 dozen of these dams per drainage. More, she said emphatically, maybe 8 to 10 dozen in each of the drainages. The structures didn't initially work as planned. A fire had left much of the ridge barren. Every time a big rain came in, summer or fall, water and soil were flushed down the drainage, blowing out check dam after check dam. I asked Valor how she'd kept her faith up. Her answer was simple. Well, we just kept on repairing them, fortifying them. A few kept blowing out, but more and more of them held. Then in one big rain, char, blackened bark, and mud slowly filled in behind the check dams and stayed in place. It was like a big slicker slowly sinking in and locking things in place. The dirt started to build up and stay behind each dam, raising the level of soil by several feet each year. Pretty soon, the water spread out across the entire canyon bottom. Gradually, a quarter-mile-long marsh developed where there used to be barren rock. Juan and I walked around as we listened to Valor, nudging our boot heels into the dirt, looking at its color and texture. Charcoal and microbe-rich soil weren't the only things the floods brought in. She pointed to water-loving sedges and a half-dozen kinds of grasses. A few hundred sycamore tree seedlings stood before us. Valor and her team didn't plant them. The slowed-down floodwaters brought sycamore seeds, which stayed and germinated. Oh, and now frogs and toads arrive after big rains. I just saw a heron catch one, she said. Juan asked how many of these structures the Guanajuato stonemasons had built on the entire ranch. Valor said, we stopped counting at 20,000. Valor may have stopped counting, but she hasn't stopped investing in restoring rich soil and fresh water. As she spoke, I realized that she regarded these resources as every person's birthright, and the care of the land our collective responsibility. Juan and I later learned that Valor was being rather modest in her estimate of how many check dams she supported. Scientists with the U.S. Geological Survey inventoried more than 40,000 check dams put in place by the Guanajuato Canteros. The scientists also found that the dams captured 630 tons of moisture-holding soil in just 3 years. One creek with a check dam had its flows during the rainy season reduced by half, so they were steadier, less flashy, and less capable of doing erosive damage. The restored creek was able to sustain at least 28% greater flow volume than a comparable unrestored creek bed. These stabilized flows ended up replenishing groundwater below the check dams. Downstream, mile-long stretches are running year-round where they were once seasonally dry. The check dam sooner or later brought back water striders, turtles, toads, frogs, fish, dippers, quail, coatimundis, and even large predatory cats. In fact, the quail on El Coronado helped pay for the Cuenca de los Ojos restoration work. Seasoned game bird hunters pay thousands of dollars for a week in the restored watershed, hunting three different species, mierns, gambels, and scaled quail. Today, the descendants of the first stonemasons continue to build and repair check dams on lands managed by Valor. It's become one of the most remarkable, multi-generational, trans-border collaborations ever accomplished in the Mexico-U.S. borderlands. I've seldom heard a discouraging word from Valor's neighbors about the work accomplished by the Guanajuato Canteros over the past few decades. If nearby ranchers have any reservation, it's that they don't always have the money to similarly restore their own land's natural capital. Now that she's put livestock back on some of her restored lands, local ranchers have even more empathy for her efforts. Her healed land is yielding food again. Built with boulders and cobbles. While Valor has invested serious capital in restoration, enormous sums of money aren't necessarily required to thoroughly change a landscape. Ranchers and range managers of lesser means are doing similar work, albeit on a different scale. My favorite low-capital, high-impact builder of water wealth and soil fertility is Joe Quiroga. He's been foreman on the Diamond C Ranch for most of the time I've known him. Around the time Joe turned 60, he began an endeavor that's done more for land conservation than most of us will ever achieve. Having been temporarily relieved of managing the ranch's cattle, he began to devote 100% of his time to managing the land itself. One day, Joe looked out over the storm-scoured but dry watercourses of the Canelo Hills in Arizona's Santa Cruz County and decided he'd try to heal their wounds. He began to build a kind of stone check dam that looked slightly different from the Guanajuato trincheras. Wherever Joe saw shallow waterways eroding into deep gullies, he constructed check dams. Every week, year after year, Joe rearranged the erratic boulders exposed in gullies or on the sides of ridges, moving dozens of them to span drainages. Years later, Joe can now look out over the land and see the healing power of more than 1,200 rock-solid check dams he designed and built with boulders and cobbles. The dams have brought back steady stream flows, and they hold tons of soil and roots in place on the Diamond C, creating a little miracle of greenery in the otherwise cinnamon-colored Canelo Hills. Joe single-handedly returned running water and fertility to the floodplain where it was formerly scoured clean. Streams gently flow for the first time in decades, and a dozen native grass species provide perennial cover. When I asked Joe why he'd mounted such a Herculean effort, his simple no-nonsense answer was, because the land needed it. When men a half century younger than Joe asked this muscular 75-year-old if he had any help moving boulders as big as whiskey barrels, he says, "Sure, I had a little help." To their surprise, Joe mentions that he used a digging bar, a pulley, and ratchet hooked to the back of his pickup and a bumper. Otherwise, this massive effort has been accomplished entirely by Joe's two hands and observant eyes, bright mind, and big heart. All that's keeping any of us from doing our part in taking care of the land is some kind of tunnel vision, Joe said. It blocks us from seeing that what we ourselves want for the land is more or less the same as what our neighbors want. That tunnel vision can paralyze us from taking action to do what virtually all of us would agree needs to be done. Joe simply wants the land to be productive enough for his descendants to make a living. The Quiroga family has lived in Santa Cruz County for at least 6 generations, but some of the best and brightest kin have recently left in search of decent jobs. This lack of opportunity concerns Joe, who's been known to plaster bumper stickers on his pickup expressing support for beef production and mining. This may irk environmentalists who pass Joe on the road, but he has a certain pragmatism that rings true to me. If land restoration and soil conservation can create enough jobs to keep his kids in the county, I'm sure he'd welcome those activities with open arms. But if it takes extractive industries to keep the 21st century equivalent of brain drain from socially impoverishing his community, Joe won't disparage those pursuits either. On Earth Day 2012, more than 70 of Joe's neighbors and a half dozen organizations, including farmers, ranchers, scientists, permaculturists, and community activists, came together to honor him at the Santa Cruz County Earth Fest. Republicans, Democrats, Sagebrush Rebellion, Libertarians, and former Earth Firsters all paid homage to a homegrown hero who didn't fit any single label because he transcended them all. It was clear to everyone present that Joe's patient day-by-day work has left a legacy that'll live on for decades, if not centuries. Despite their cultural, political, and even economic differences, Joe Quiroga and Valor Clark share something special. They each take the long view of land, health, and have striven to make the world a greener, wetter place for all. Gary Paul Nabin is a father of the local food movement. He's written and edited more than 30 books, including Food from the Radical Center, Island Press, from which this article is excerpted. You are listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona. This is Earth and Home, and I am your volunteer broadcaster, Carol Hampton. Now back to Mother Earth News. Healing Our Land and Communities. In this book, author Gary Paul Nabin tells the stories of diverse communities who are getting their hands dirty and bringing back North America's unique fare: bison, sturgeon, camas, lilies, ancient grains, turkeys, and more. These efforts have united people from all walks of life who are working to restore America's natural wealth, its ability to produce healthy foods. This title is available at www.motherearthnews.com/store or by calling 800-234-3368. Mention promo code MMEPAKZ5, item number 9942. And again, the number is 800-234-3368. Now let's move on to HGTV.com. Do's and don'ts for the kitchen junk drawer. Has your kitchen drawer become a jumble of odds and ends? Make it work harder with these organizing tips. By Lisa Frederick. Everyone has a kitchen junk drawer, just right for all the little treasures that have nowhere else to go. But when it becomes a tangle of half-empty lip balm, pencil stubs, and mysterious keys, it's time to take action. It can be useful to have a catch-all drawer in your kitchen for items you want to keep handy, but it's a good idea to have at least a modicum of organization so that you can find what you need, says Janine Adams, certified professional organizer and owner of Peace of Mind Organizing in St. Louis, Missouri. Follow these steps to keep the drawer from overflowing. Empty the drawer, remove all the contents, set them on the countertop, and sort them into categories. Take the opportunity to dust and wipe the drawer and tuck in a non-slip drawer liner. Discard or relocate certain items. Keep in mind that centrally located kitchen drawers are best reserved for items you use frequently, need, and or like. Remove the items that don't belong in the prime real estate of a kitchen drawer, Adams says, like duplicate takeout menus, expired coupons, surplus twist ties, and tools that have migrated into the kitchen. Toss the obvious trash and move the rest of the items where they belong. Toiletries to the bath, tools to the garage, and so on. Add a drawer organizer. Place a simple tray or divider in the drawer to separate belongings. If your drawer is large or oddly shaped, an adjustable style comes in handy. Replace the items you want to keep, organizing them by category. If you assign a place for each of the items in their respective categories in the drawer, you'll be able to quickly put your hands on what you're looking for, Adam says. Group like items. Don't let the drawer contents become haphazard. Clip takeout menus together in a small folder or binder. Gather electronics chargers together in a small bag and organize unexpired coupons in a small box. Corral tiny items. If your junk drawer holds small, easily lost items such as paper clips, push pins, rubber bands, or safety pins, add an appropriate container to hold them. Depending on drawer size, small jars, cups, muffin tins, or ice cube trays can do the trick. Know what not to store. Sort your drawer regularly. Keep it stocked with items you want to access frequently and removing those that don't belong. While drawer contents depend on your needs, you can usually winnow out food, soy sauce and ketchup packets, broken items, junk mail, old receipts, old birthday cards, expired credit cards, coins, and batteries. Deal with overflow items. If your drawer is too full, consider adding a storage solution that serves double duty as a stylish countertop display. For instance, pens can be organized in a glass canister, and notepads can be stacked in a small bamboo basket. Keep the drawer organized. To keep your junk drawer from getting out of control, set a reminder to clean and reorganize every so often. You can do this whenever it's convenient, when you're paying bills, after your weekend coffee and crossword puzzle ritual, or during your regular kitchen cleanup. Now let's move on to Better Homes and Gardens. Better, your guide to a happy, healthy life. Each year, nearly 60 million Americans have their identity stolen. Monitoring your credit reports can help protect against fraud, but 66% of Americans never or rarely do. Check your credit at least once a year. By law, you get a free annual report from each of the three major credit agencies, Equifax, Experian, and TransUnion. Experian and the app Credit Karma also offer monitoring services. A Mediterranean-style diet may lower inflammation and boost mental health, according to a new study. After 3 months of eating this way, people scored 35% lower on a depression scale. They also had less anxiety and stress. They focused on eating fruits and vegetables, whole grains, fish, nuts, unsweetened dairy, olive oil, and lean protein. 840 milligrams of fish oil in fatty fish like salmon and tuna helps protect against a heart attack. People who took fish oil supplements were also less likely to die from heart disease. Eat at least 2 servings of fatty fish weekly, or talk to your doctor about a supplement. February 7th, National Wear Red Day. Put on your favorite red to raise awareness about heart disease. It's the leading cause of death among American women and men, but 80% of cardiac events can be prevented. Visit goredforwomen.org for the latest research and information about heart disease in women. February 11th is Safer Internet Day. Have a family conversation about the risks and how to be smart and safe. More than half of teens have been bullied online. Talk to your kids about what sites and apps they're using and who they're interacting with online. For more information and tools, visit Safer Internet Day US and connectsafely.org. And that's SAFERINTERNETDAY.US. And the other one is CONNECTSAFELY.ORG. We have time for one more short article from Better Homes and Gardens. Petiquette. Even the most well-mannered pets don't always behave. Experts weigh in on how to handle four sticky situations. 1. Your friend's dog jumps on you whenever you visit. Don't greet or pet the dog until she has all four paws on the ground. Giving any attention to the dog when she jumps on you reinforces the behavior. Also, try refocusing the dog's attention by asking her to sit and not acknowledging her until she does, says Mikkel Becker, lead trainer for FearFreeHappyHomes.com in Spokane, Washington, and co-author of From Fearful to Fear-Free. Crouching to the dog's level when you greet her can also reduce the likelihood of jumping. One strategy pet owners can use is to crate the dog until guests have been there 10 to 15 minutes, then introduce your pet while on a leash. Close friends could talk about doing this. 2. Dogs often leave an unwelcome gift in your yard. 2. Dogs often leave an unwelcome gift in your yard. Don't assume the worst. The owner may have forgotten or run out of poop bags. If you see it happening in real time, politely ask if they need a poop bag. You can also put up a friendly sign and even attach bags, reminding owners to pick up after their dog. Another diplomatic way to address the problem, ask your neighborhood or condo association to email a reminder. 3. A dog off-leash approaches you. Watch the dog's body language. If the tail is high, the dog's mouth is pursed, or she seems stiff, those are signs the dog is stressed and might bite. Stay calm, don't yell, and try to position yourself behind a barrier like a parked car. If you're a pet parent, always keep your dog leashed in public unless you're in a designated off-leash area, says Travis Borson, pet expert and Animal Planet trainer. You have a responsibility to your dog and others who may not feel comfortable around dogs, Brosen says. 4. The cat next door keeps pouncing at birds at your feeders. Your best bet is to try and make the feeder less accessible to the cat. Place feeders and bird baths 10 to 12 feet away from possible cat hiding spots, under bushes, porches, and decks. If necessary, replace feeders with beds of native plants. They won't attract a high concentration of birds to one spot, so would be less likely to catch the cat's attention. By Karen Asp. You can listen to this and most other SunSounds programs at your convenience with On Demand. Go to sunsounds.org and click Broadcast Info and Audio. We are at the conclusion of this week's Earth and Home program. This is your SunSounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster, Carol Hampton. Thank you for tuning in this week. Join me next time for another new and informative program. Have a great week and stay tuned to SunSounds of Arizona.